I didn't know what I was doing. This is a quote from New York federal prosecutor Leslie Caldwell, the woman who put Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols, Pappy Mason, and Gerald Prince Miller in prison for life sentences. Caldwell's quote is from a New York Times article where she was reflecting on her early career when she was making her name by putting away all the black queens drug kingpins of the 1980s whose names had been splashed across newspaper headlines. She was saying that she didn't know what she was doing because she was a new prosecutor. But as I researched the history of the Supreme Team and I came across her quote, it jumped out at me, as in fact, there is something more complex to understand here. Ask yourself, what's the reason for police, prosecutors, prison? It's to make society safer, okay. There does need to be police in prisons, but there's several existential problems at the heart of the American criminal justice system. First, drugs. Americans like to do drugs, but we also like to put the people who sell the drugs in prison. Now, lots of people sold cocaine in the 1980s across all demographics. But for economic reasons, black drug dealers were generally the ones operating at the retail level, standing on the corner. And the imagery of gold chain wearing black kids killing each other on the nightly news was an easy sell for the media.
From what I knew about the old gangs of Al Capone, that there was most often a reason for people being hurt, maimed, or killed. Here, if they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that can be enough reason in and of itself.
One of the few retail cocaine dealing groups that stands alone, really, for their impact on American pop culture was and is the Supreme Team. Since I did an initial story on the Supreme Team several years ago, I've become friends with Supreme's son Kyle, and I've communicated with Gerald Prince Miller. In fact, we were all set to do a phone interview, but his prison was put on lockdown. Hopefully that will happen soon. What I'm going to talk about isn't so much the crimes of the so-called Supreme Team. What I want to talk about is how crime and so-called criminals are valuable commodities to lots of people and groups. They're brands, from police to music labels and television reporters. Did you know that Chris Hansen of To Catch a Predator fame got his big break riding around with the Detroit Police Department's infamous No Crack crew back in the mid-80s? Chris Hansen is the one who was with them when they discovered the infamous home videos of the Chambers Brothers gang from Detroit counting money. The clip that is always used in almost every single documentary about the so-called crack era in urban America.
Can we throw these ones away, man, since we got $500,000?
I'll tell you what we can do. We can give it to the poor.
That's exactly what I say, too. We'll just donate those to the poor.
The amounts of drugs that the various incarnations, associates, and pretenders of the Supreme Team sold was really nothing in the grand scheme of the New York City drug business. But their catchy name and charismatic members made them permanent fixtures in the newspapers, pop culture, and in the eyes of law enforcement. The original Supreme Team, some would say the real Supreme Team, probably ended in 1985, before crack had even become widespread. Bimmy Antony, an original member and Waka Flocka Flame's uncle, told me on the phone recently that when Supreme McGriff went to prison in 85, the Supreme Team was just selling powder cocaine, not crack, and that it was Bimmy, Prince Miller, and others who were on the streets to launch the crack era for the Supreme Team in Queens.
No crack hotline, can I help you?
Crack Inc., the big business and big money of the most potent form of cocaine, crack.
I mean, everybody knew Supreme Team because we were in South Jamaica, Queens. So everybody back then knew Supreme Team. There was no emphasis on paying attention to this, or there was no emphasis on a regular person, a civilian, having any knowledge of this stuff. There was no social currency in having that type of information, so it didn't matter. Unlike now. To us, and everybody knows this, whether you're from Queens or otherwise, you know, and I got a lot of homies, you know, from Queens. You know, shout out to Big D, one of my dearest, oldest and dearest friends. So there was nothing happening in 40 Projects or Baisley that was any different than Pink Houses in Brooklyn. There was nothing that was happening in Queens on a regular basis comparable to the South Bronx, comparable to Harlem, comparable to Brooklyn. It wasn't like that. So getting money in Queens was about as tumultuous as people wanted it to be.
The drug business got its first big start in Southeast Queens when a man named Pop Freeman, who worked for the Genovese crime family, was sent from Harlem to establish heroin street dealing along Liberty Avenue in South Jamaica in the early 60s. At that time, the Italian Mafia controlled almost all the heroin coming in the country, and they were the bank for the illegal betting system known as the numbers that so many people participated in. Pop Freeman was sent to Southeast Queens because it was lucrative. It was New York's largest black middle-class area. Bimmy told me that he worked for Pop Freeman as a kid, I think, in his convenience store. By the time 1980 rolled around, Pop Freeman was retiring. A man named Ronald Bumps Bassett was tapped by Freeman to be a successor in the heroin biz. He became the local Nicky Barnes around Queens. The federal government once tracked $15 million in street sales to Bump Bassett over just a 9-week period. Perhaps the Supreme Team was first supplied by Bumps Bassett or even Pop Freeman.
And Tyson was dealing with a lady. She was about getting money too. She had opened up a game room, pool room, which was, you know, a common front business. You know, stay out there with big ass 9mm and long dimes of cocaine. And so we out there on Sutphin and Foch, right, South Jamaica. There's a park that the Prem is locked up by now. The Supreme Team is popping, but he's not on the street. So they doing shit in the park and all that, you know, whatever. They doing what they do. The Jamaicans of the Shower and Spangler, you know, they on some shit. They busting at each other, and you know, we had a little thing going on, in opposition to them or whatever. Because we was doing our thing, you know what I mean? So
Kenneth Supreme McGriff himself got his start in the drug world working as a stash house guard for Bumps Bassett. Federal court records tell us that Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols set up shop in 1981 in Southeast Queens selling cocaine and heroin, and he was definitely supplied by Bumps Bassett at first. Perhaps that means that the drugs were still coming from the Italians. Who knows? By the admission of original Supreme Team members, the team wasn't making the level of money as Fat Cat Nichols or the less well-known Corley family who controlled the 40 Projects. But to quote an original member, the team was the greatest show on earth. All this was happening in a short span between 83 to 85. That's when all the legends were made and the mythology was built that we still think of as the Supreme Team today. That's what 50 Cent rapped about.
Supreme, I knew. Fat Cat, I did not. From Queens, from just being around. I mean, but he wasn't around very much or very long.
Prince Miller was in jail until 1984 for something else. And when he got out, Kenneth McGriff already had the Supreme Team rolling. So it's interesting how Supreme McGriff went to prison for the first time, and it lets you know that the NYPD had made them one of their chief targets. A confidential informant told the police about the robbery of a Supreme Team stash house on Linden Boulevard on July 5th in 1985. Somehow, this makes a judge give out warrants to raid a whole bunch of addresses in Queens associated with the Supreme Team. So how being a victim of a robbery leads to raids on your homes, I don't know. But Supreme was caught personally in one of these raids. There were drugs in the house. There were bulletproof hats, jackets, and shirts, according to the police reports, though that seems kind of hard to believe. I don't know. Supreme got out on bail, and they held his nephew Prince's 22nd birthday party at a popular local nightclub.
To my man, my brother, wait with us right now, you with us in heart and mind.
I think I might have met Prem in the fever. You know what I mean? Because I was going with the fever 1980, 80, 81, 82.
Kenneth McGriff was picked up on a lone indictment by the federal government. He was the only person in the indictment for an 848, running a continuing criminal enterprise.
In their battle against the drug gangs, authorities are using new federal racketeering laws, like the one against operating a continuing criminal enterprise.
McGriff eventually took a deal for 12 years, which is a pretty light sentence for running a continuing criminal enterprise. So that's why the NYPD and the feds always kind of considered him the one that got away. He really didn't do that much time initially.
Crack has become America's drug of choice.
So McGriff catches his case in 85. I think he was on the street a little longer fighting it, but he gets busted in 85, bumps Bassett and Fat Cat, the two probably biggest black dealers in Queens at the time. They were locked up in the summer of 85 also. So 85 really marks the end of the so-called golden age. These fun times they show you in the rap videos, it was over a long time ago. Lots of people started getting long prison terms, and the murder rate actually only got higher and higher after 1985 as the more organized groups and leaders like Supreme and Fat Cat and Bassett were sent away.
That it set a whole thing in motion, and all that money that the people, the prosecution, and law enforcement trying to get the, you know, the politicians to shake loose so they can, you know,
James
do.
Shaking.
Yeah, started shaking.
When a police officer is murdered, the killer should pay with his life.
Police are trying something new here, a tactical narcotics team called TNT. It's a coordinated effort by city, state, and federal officers, and more than 100 of them are closing down crack dens and arresting drug dealers.
TNT, man, that first it was just a short thing, and it was just in Queens. But then, of course, somebody's obviously it's an opportunity to get money. At the same time, not everybody that was behind expanding that program was in it to get the money. Some of them were like, this is the help we need.
Many people in the neighborhood are afraid, and some say TNT is only a band-aid.
So why is the Supreme Team so much more well-known than, say, Bumps Bassett, who was from the same area and era and was a much bigger drug dealer? Is it just because Supreme had a better nickname? As crazy as that sounds, it might be true, because I couldn't even find Bassett's picture anywhere on the internet.
Right now, there's somebody watching this right now and going, oh man, Queens was this, that, and the other. There ain't nothing about Queens that I do not know with that thing. But the fact is, Queens did not have the type of aggressive environment that Harlem at that time, the South Bronx at that time, Brooklyn at that time had. It just didn't.
Could it be that part of the reason the Supreme Team story was so popular in the New York media was because it was in the most suburban borough, the whitest borough?
Yeah, that's completely plausible, you know.
The Supreme Team was a brand name. I've studied all sorts of different criminal operations around America in different times and different places, and I realized something interesting and disturbing. Criminal groups can have brand names like Nike, like Tesla, like the Bloods, as it's used by rappers to promote themselves. Would there ever have been the brief phenomenon of Tekashi 6ix9ine if he didn't have real gang members to validate him? And where would 50 Cent be if he wasn't able to use his very real beef with the very real gangster Kenneth Supreme McGriff to promote himself? He still talks about Supreme to this day. But think about this also. Brand names and crime are useful for more than just rappers cashing in on the violence of black urban street life. Criminal brand names are also useful to two other groups, the media and law enforcement, as we just saw. The Supreme Team sold newspapers and got promotions for the cops and prosecutors that put them in jail. But the saga of the Supreme Team wasn't over. In a way, it was just beginning.
But because of, you know, what Gerald and them were doing, they kept the name popping, you know, kept the name out there, whatever.
Supreme's nephew, Gerald Prince Miller, still had 5 years ahead of him, controlling a group still called the Supreme Team, and it would come back to haunt him. He's still in prison now, whether he's guilty or not.
Were you involved in any way in the death of Tupac Shakur?
I mean, I'm like a victim. You know what I'm saying? I feel, you know what I'm saying, sorry for him. I mean, I've been thinking, you know, maybe I'm an scapegoat or something. I just want to let everybody know, you know what I'm saying, I didn't do it.
Hey, but the funny shit, I got shot 5 times, ain't damn bullet go on my chest.
After Pac died, death row changed drastically.
I told Dog, I'm getting off of death row and get the fuck out of here.
You know, because we were death row, and that's the life we was living. We felt like we was untouchable until that fatal day.
I never had any beef with anybody from the East. I'm here to make good music. That's what I signed my contract to Death Row Records for.
If God give me breath for 20 more years, I see myself changing the world.
I got song with Snoop, I got song with Corrupt, Nas, Rage, Fade for Bad Boy.
There you go.
I seen Biggie throwing up this. Biggie don't know nothing about no gang sign.